Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is editor and science journalist Keith Cooper, and we are continuing our conversation about his book, Amazing Worlds of Science Fiction and Science Fact. Keith, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book. I enjoyed this book so much. I think that's because I love science fiction, but I also really love astronomy and hard science. And I just want to, for the benefit of the audience, and you can chime in, the conceit of your book is that there's an actual search for exoplanets, planets outside of our solar system, and they have found a lot. And how that ties up with living and life on other planets that people who write science fiction and have directed science fiction movies have come up with. And it's a fascinating idea that it ends up that people who've done speculative fiction, science fiction, really have investigated what is possible on life with really different from Earth conditions. Is that safe to say what the book is about?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, we've discovered 6,000 exoplanets.
That's amazing. But there's a limit to what we can know about these planets.
There is at the moment.
Okay.
We're only limited by our technology. So when we have bigger telescopes and better instruments, we'll be able to learn more. We're really at the beginning of this kind of an exoplanet adventure, even though it's been 30 years since we discovered the first exoplanets. Our instruments now are vastly superior to even 30 years ago, and in 30 years' time in the future, they'll be even better, and we'll be able to start, hopefully, imaging, you know, some of these planets and seeing if any of them are like Earth. So it's really a limitation of technology, and we just need to improve our technology to learn more about them.
And it's important to emphasize that to date, no other planet that's like Earth is known, exactly like Earth.
Yeah, we may have found one, but we don't recognize it yet. Again, it's that limit of technology that we're not able to really tell just yet. We've certainly found some rocky planets that are in what we describe as the habitable zone, which is
the Goldilocks zone.
It's this zone, you know, the zone from a star where it's warm enough for liquid water. The nearest exoplanet to the solar system, Proxima B, it orbits the star Proxima Centauri, just 4.2 light years away. That is in the habitable zone. So technically, theoretically, that, you know, as long as it has an atmosphere that's able to retain some heat, in theory, that should be able to support, you know, oceans. Now, whether it can support life is a completely different matter. But but we just can't tell. Even something that's just 4 light years away, we cannot tell whether that is Earth-like or not, because we just don't have the telescopes powerful enough to do that yet.
One of the things that fascinated me about your book are the astrophysicists and the cosmologists and the astronomers who will talk about or make references to some of their favorite science fiction. And one of the authors that seems to come up several times is the author Larry Niven's. Is that true? He seems to be fairly popular among scientists.
Yeah, I think so, especially among a certain generation. So Larry Niven started writing science fiction, I guess, in the late 50s. He became more popular towards the end of the late 60s and into the 1970s. His most famous book is Ringworld, which won the Hugo Award.
Well, let's talk about what Ringworld was, because it's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, so Ringworld was an artificial world, and it was this huge band, a huge belt-shaped artifact structure that went all the way around a star. And on the inside of this belt, it was like a planet was laid out. There was mountains and seas and deserts, and it was all artificial. It had all been artificially built. And in the story, our heroes crash land on Ringworld and encounter some of the denizens of Ringworld and have to figure out how to get off it. So that's an example of what you might call a megastructure, something like a Dyson sphere. A Dyson sphere, you may have recognize is a huge spherical swarm of solar collectors that would encapsulate a star, and they would, you know, collect all the radiant energy from a star and collect it all. So Ringworld is a little bit similar, except it's just in a belt, and on the interior of it is this vast landscape, enormous, going all the way around the star. And they only explore a portion of it. And
well, let's talk about some of the planets that have been used in science fiction, both film and written, and talk about how habitable they could be. Let's talk about planets of sand, like really hot planets. And I'm talking about things like Arrakis in Dune and Tatooine in Star Wars. When you look at the planets as they're laid out, it really seems like not a great place for life. Is life possible?
In theory, again, we don't have a desert planet on hand to test our theories, but certainly the way that scientists approach this is that water is a greenhouse gas. It's in our atmosphere. It helps keep our planet warm. It also freezes when it gets cold. So if you have lots of water, your planet is liable to either get too hot through a runaway greenhouse effect or to freeze over and everything turns to ice. But on a desert planet, you don't have that much water, so you're not going to turn into a giant snowball and you're not going to have a runaway greenhouse effect. So as long as there's a little bit of water, then in theory, life should be able to persist, and it should be quite a stable environment. Whether there would be enough water to support complex, large animal life is debatable. So whether you really have sandworms like in Dune, maybe not, but it wouldn't. I mean, like, you know, we find life in Earth deserts.
That's right.
Where there's not a lot of water, but life adapts. Life finds a way, as Jeff Goldblum said in Jurassic Park. And as long as there's some water, life tends to figure out how to use it and to use it carefully. Even in Dune, there were these little rodents, and we actually, in most recent movies, we actually catch sight of one of them.
Yeah.
They look like mice, and they have these big ears. The ears, actually, they're not for listening, or maybe they do listen through them, but it's also for capturing moisture from the atmosphere, and it helps keep them alive, and that's how they survive. So it's these little adaptations that allow life to persist. I'd imagine that if a planet has always been desert, it's probably not going to be able to develop any life beyond microbial life, because, as I said, you need more water than that to facilitate larger, more complex organisms. But you can imagine a planet like Earth that slowly turns into a desert. It's possible, maybe, that some life could figure out a way of how to, not go extinct and to adapt itself to living those conditions. But I think if push came to shove, I'd rather live on an Earth-like world with our monsoons and oceans rather than on a desert world where you've just got the sun never-ending.
Well, you talked about water and the possibility of it all freezing. That happened on Earth. We became a snowball planet in our geological history.
Absolutely. At least on two occasions, possibly more. And we can see this in the geological record. We're still not entirely sure why this happened. There could be a number of factors, possibly if there had been lots of volcanic eruptions, maybe super volcanoes that spewed lots of dust into the atmosphere. It could have blocked the sunlight. Obviously, with less sunlight, temperatures would plummet on Earth. We're talking hundreds of millions of years ago. Probably, I think the most recent one was about 700 million years ago. So,
and there was life on the planet at that point.
Yeah, absolutely, there was life. Not complex animal life, but certainly microbial life and, amoebas and things like that.
And it survived Snowball Earth.
Yeah. And the suspicion is maybe not the whole of the Earth turned to ice. There may have been regions where it could have just been, atmospheric circulation meant that some areas stayed a little bit warmer. So maybe life was able to survive there. And also in the oceans, even though, you know, the top of the ocean may have turned into a shell of ice, underneath would still have been water. And it would have been insulated by the ice. So similar to, say, Lake Vostok in Antarctica, which is an underground lake that hasn't seen daylight in 15 million years. And the speculation that there could be all kinds of weird and wonderful life in there that has evolved its own way and hasn't had contact with the outside world. So, yeah, snowball worlds don't necessarily mean... It would be bad for our kind of life. You know, human life, I don't think, would survive the Earth turning into a snowball planet. But certainly on the microbial level, it seems to carry on just fine. And then when conditions return to be more clement, then evolution can start happening again. And that's exactly what happened on Earth. It's about 100 million years after, you know, the end of the last snowball Earth phase, we had this eruption of lots of complex forms of life, the Cambrian explosion. Nobody really knows what caused it, but the fact that it followed this deep ice age is maybe not a coincidence. And it was from the Cambrian explosion that the complex life started to evolve and develop.
Well, as you write about in Amazing Worlds, we really need to better understand how Earth works and what makes it habitable, because people may take it for granted that we understand all that. We don't.
Absolutely. And, you know, when people scoff and think, oh, these planets are either make-believe in science fiction or they're dozens of light years away, what's the relevance to us? More important things. You just hit the nail on the head. It's about we can use these planets, whether in fiction or in fact, to compare to Earth and to better understand how Earth operates and how come Earth is habitable and that we're here. Without these other planets, we'd just have a data point of one, and we can't learn anything from that because we wouldn't know whether Earth is unusual or not. It's absolutely everything we learn about exoplanets, everything we learn about the planets in the solar system, all these imaginative worlds in science fiction, that it all comes back to, you know, how does this compare to Earth? How does it help us understand Earth better? So it's all relevant.
And speaking of icy worlds, I mean, our best shot, it seems, of finding other life, not on Earth, but in our solar system, is on some of these icy moons of the gas giants.
Absolutely. Europa, Jupiter, one of Jupiter's icy moons, has a subsurface ocean beneath about a dozen or so miles of ice. There's this global ocean with more water than is even on Earth. And the speculation that life could exist there. Probably not things like whales and dolphins, nothing that big, but certainly microbial life. There's other icy moons in the solar system as well. Enceladus, which orbits Saturn, has a similar subterranean ocean. Ganymede, the largest moon in the solar system, it's actually bigger than Mercury. We think that has an ocean. And I wouldn't rule out Mars as well, which Mars is a desert planet. There's not much water, not very warm, but there's not much water there. So that's kind of a desert planet. Scientists know that conditions on Mars billions of years ago could have supported life. Whether it did or not, we don't know. But
there was a lot of water on the surface. We know that.
There was. Now, a lot of it escaped into space. A lot of it has gone underground. Some of it is frozen in ice caps. Maybe we'll find evidence of microbial life on Mars in the past. Maybe there's still some there. There's anomalous plumes of methane that have been detected on Mars. Scientists don't know whether that is produced by geological activity or biological activity. Hmm. So it's entirely possible that there could be microbial colonies living in rocks in certain parts of Mars right now. We just don't know. And it's kind of extraordinary that, you know, we're talking about these exoplanets a long, long, long away, you know, around stars that are light years away, and we asking whether they can support life. We don't even know whether the planets in our own solar system, our next-door neighbors, whether they can support life or not at the moment. We've still got a lot of exploration to do in the solar system.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is editor and science journalist Keith Cooper. And we're continuing our conversation about his book. It's really fascinating to read. Amazing Worlds of Science Fiction and Science Fact. What the hell happened to Venus? Is the current understanding that Venus was probably a bit more habitable in a million years or so ago, and now it's just turned into a hellhole? I mean, I've heard people describe Venus as like the worst place in the solar system.
Oh, it is today, yes. It's, on the surface of Venus today, the temperature reaches 450 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's a lot. And the pressure is 90 times greater than the surface pressure on Earth. So if you don't melt, you'll be crushed. So either way, you're not going to last very long on Venus. But whether it ever was once habitable depends on who you talk to. Scientists have different opinions about this. It's interesting, if you go back to Victorian times, Victorian astronomers thought that Venus was this paradise world, that it was all jungle and swamp.
That's
and
right. That was a popular conceit in early science fiction movies and goofy science fiction movies, too. Like,
yeah,
the queen of outer space was Zsa Zsa Gabor, I think, was on Venus.
Yeah, but that was because Venus was so bright. They thought it was a very steamy atmosphere, and that's why it was reflecting sunlight and appeared so bright. It wasn't until the space age, and really that we could send spacecraft to Venus, that we discovered the truth that it's just this horrible carbon dioxide atmosphere with sulfuric clouds of sulfuric acid. So yeah, it really is a hellish planet, but maybe a billion years ago, or 4 billion years ago, possibly, it would have received. So we think Earth's water came from asteroid impacts, the asteroids
right.
that carried the water impacted Earth, and this would have happened 4 billion years ago. And all these asteroids that impacted Earth would also have impacted Venus and Mars. So Venus, 4 billion years ago, would have had water. Now, it's a little bit closer to the sun, so it's warmer. Its climate would have warmed up faster, and the water would have evaporated. But when that happened, it's certainly up for debate. Some planetary scientists think it was less than a billion years ago. Others think that Venus has been inhospitable for 4 billion years. These deep spans of time going back, it's really difficult to fully understand what happened then, because all the evidence, has kind of been lost, and we're trying to pick out pieces of the jigsaw without having the whole picture and just trying to put it together. But it's possible that Venus could have been very Earth-like, and it fell off the barrel it's not nice now.
Well, let's talk about the opposite. Let's talk about water worlds, ocean worlds. As you write in your book, and it's sort of surprising because if you don't think about it, it sounds wild. Water isn't rare in our solar system. The problem is it's mostly ice. But to conceive of an exoplanet that's a total ocean world, a good example was in the film Interstellar, and they land on an ocean world. And ocean water worlds in science fiction, there's a lot of them. And there's a weird word, panthalassic, that's used to describe water worlds. Where's that from?
That was coined by the science fiction author Alistair Reynolds, who had a water world in one of his stories. So I'm not entirely sure where he got that word from, whether he invented it himself based on, it must be based on some kind of geological terms, or whether it is a word used by other scientists. I have to admit, it was the first time I'd come across it, but I thought it was such a cool word.
It is a cool word.
Yeah. Water itself, it's just H2O. It's two atoms of hydrogen, which is the most common element in the entire universe, and oxygen, which is also one of the most common elements in the universe. So it's not surprising then that water is also really common. And you're right, it's everywhere in the solar system. It's frozen in comets. It's, in frozen moons.
But a planet entirely of water with no land, at first blush, a lot of people think, well, that's perfect. There should be life there. But there are problems if you have no land and only water. I think I remember reading in your book that some scientists have figured out that a planet like that couldn't maintain a carbon silicate cycle if there's no land. You need some land.
Yeah, because the nutrients in the ocean come from the land, come from weathering on the land that drives the nutrients off in the runoff from rain, water that ends up in streams, that ends up in rivers, that flows into the oceans. Without land, where's the nutrient source? And if you have an ocean world where there's no land, that ocean is going to be maybe hundreds of kilometers deep. So the seabed is going to be far too deep as well to supply nutrients to the top part of the ocean. So where does that nutrient source come from? And again, we don't have an example of an ocean world really in our solar system, and so we. Figuring out how these all work is all based on computer simulations where we input our best estimates at the various properties of the planet and then see what happens. But in the future, our sun is going to heat up. In a billion years' time, Earth is going to be too hot for life because the sun has heated up. And in about 5 billion years' time, the sun is going to start to evolve into what we call a red giant. And when that happens, the outer solar system is going to get warmer. Moons like Europa, which are mostly ice with a rocky core, they're going to start melting. So they are going to turn into water worlds. And we already have an ocean underground, but all the ice on the surface is also going to melt. So in the future, we will have these ocean worlds in our solar system when that happens. Unfortunately, we're not going to be around to witness that. But if we can find, ocean worlds orbiting other stars, and if we can get telescopes that are sensitive enough to start to learn more about them, then maybe we can figure out how these worlds would work and whether they could support life or not. Nobody really knows. It's a lot of guesswork, a lot of estimation at the moment, and a lot of imagination in the form of science fiction.
Why are red dwarf worlds so popular?
So red dwarfs are the most common type of star in the universe. As their name suggests, they're red, which means they're fairly cool, and they're dwarves, so they're quite small. So they form about 3/4 of all stars in the universe. And we found quite a lot of planetary systems orbiting red dwarfs. Huh. Now, as you know, a red dwarf is a scaled-down sun. The planetary systems are also scaled-down solar systems. So one of the most famous planetary systems around a red dwarf is called TRAPPIST-1. And there's these 7 planets. And they're all squeezed into this area of just within 10 million kilometers of the star. You've got these 7 planets. Some of them are almost as close as the Earth is to the Moon. So
Whoa.
They're really congested close together. But they're also tidally locked, which means they always show the same hemisphere to their sun, much like the Moon always shows the same face to Earth. So you've got one side in permanent daylight, the other side is in permanent nighttime. Would the day side get too hot? Would the night side get too cold? Could an atmosphere circulate heat around to the night side? We've started looking for atmospheres on some of these worlds with the James Webb Space Telescope, and the news is pretty bad at the moment that they've looked at the innermost 4 planets of the TRAPPIST-1 system. The first 3 definitely don't have an atmosphere. The fourth one, the results are inconclusive for that at the moment. And that's interesting because the fourth one is the first of 3 planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system that are in the habitable zone. If we could find an atmosphere around one of those planets, then the chances of it supporting life, or at least being habitable, jump right up. So there's a lot riding on that, and hopefully in the next couple of years, as James Webb gets more data, we'll be able to answer that.
You talked about Mercury. Mercury's locked into position, like our moon is. And so one side is always facing the sun, the other side is always dark. So you have this weird half-hot, half-cold world right in our solar system.
Actually, Mercury does – it isn't tidally locked. It doesn't always show the same face to the sun. It just rotates quite slowly relative to it moving around the sun. So I think it completes – I got this right. It completes 3 rotations on its axis for every 2 orbits of the sun that it makes.
Wow.
So it does rotate, and all parts of the surface do see the sun, but it's just very slowly. So a day on Mercury lasts 88 days on Earth, something like that. It's a long time because it rotates so slowly. But it's not tidally locked.
Well, one of the great
used to think it was. We used to think it was even back in the '50s. You mentioned Larry Niven. His first ever short story was about was set on Mercury and Mercury being tidally locked. It was only I think in the '60s that we figured out. Oh, it isn't tidally locked. It does rotate relative to its motion around the sun.
Well, if a planet is tidally locked, is it possible? And you write about this in the book that there could be ribbon worlds. In other words, a habitable zone in between, sort of a thin ribbon all the way around the planet.
Yeah, and this is how fast that, you know, the science is changing. That was the idea that, so picture this world where, as you say, half of it is in permanent daylight and half of it is in permanent nighttime. And at the terminator between day and night, you'd have this kind of twilight. And it would be you'd have this permanent twilight. And the idea is if the day side is too hot and the night side is too cold, then at the terminator, where there's just twilight, the temperature might just be okay for liquid water and life. So you'd have this ribbon around the terminator where that would be a habitable ribbon. The thinking now, though, is if you have a planet with an atmosphere, the atmospheric circulation would be able to transport heat around to the night side. So even though the night side never, ever, ever sees the sun, it would still get some of the warmth. So that's the current thinking. And
unfortunately have to stop there, Keith, because we're out of time. And by the way, that's an indication we could talk about this book for hours. My returning guest tonight is editor and science journalist Keith Cooper, and we've been continuing our conversation. We've only scratched the surface of this book, Amazing Worlds of Science Fiction and Science Fact. Keith, it's been a real pleasure. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.